The DeFalco Files is an entertainment-based program. Some memories of certain events might be fuzzy. All opinions are that of the host. Content might not be appropriate for children and some adults. Listener discretion is advised. And remember, the truth is here. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents The DeFalco Files with FSW owner Joe DeFalco and your host, Matt Michaels.
Hey everyone, Matt Michaels here, and I am with the one and only Joe DeFalco, the owner, creator, and the head custodian, I guess, of FSW here in Vegas, Future Stars of Wrestling. It's the DeFalco Files. Joe, how are you doing?
Doing all right. You know, you threw me for a curveball. I came in, you told me we were going to have a special guest, and then when you got on the line, you said, oh, we don't have a special guest.
Yeah, I know. And that special guest will definitely be a very special guest once he's specially guesting. So,
so you know, I guess now I'm going to have to talk for an hour and a half. That's, you know, how difficult that is for me.
Well, yeah, we're going to put all the pressure on you. Today's going to be kind of a, let's call it a Royal Rumble free-for-all potpourri action-packed episode with different topics and different things we'll cover. The first thing, let's just update everyone on how it's going here in Vegas with FSW and what does it look like right now in terms of the potential of opening back up four shows.
Well, as per the governor, movement is non-existent. Nothing seems to change. I talked to my people at Impact. They called me yesterday trying to find about maybe holding dates for 2021, doing some tapings out here. But nothing can be done until it could be done. You know, the governor could walk in and say, hey, we're going to let you do this starting tomorrow, or... You know, and I don't foresee that happening. You know, we had some stuff booked here through other people. SummerSlam weekend, obviously that's not happening. Our anniversary show canceled. You know, we got a couple of events here that are going to have no fans. The LFC, which does more pay-per-view things, they're going to be here in September. My guy Ed in San Antonio, he's trying to do his predominantly women's show, and he keeps postponing it. And, you know, it's just like everything, you know, that's going on, like college football. It looks like it's going by the wayside. And, you know, so far so good with baseball, basketball, and hockey, I guess. So it's good to have some live sporting events going on. You know, we're hoping it's somebody's birthday real soon and we have a birthday party, you know.
You brought up LFC. Let me ask you this. LFC, Lingerie Fighting Championship, is doing a card in Sturgis. What do you think about that in terms of just being such a concert? So you can't do a wrestling show here with... let's say 100 people spread out in the FSW arena, but Sturgis can have 500,000 people.
Because the governor of South Dakota is letting it happen. You know, nobody's sneaking into Sturgis and it's happening. It's happening because the government says it could happen. And, you know, we always talked about being what a free country we are, but we've now learned that we're dictated by whatever they tell us to do. And there's not much we can do about it. And it's pretty disappointing that it's like, well, hey, what about people's rent? We'll work on that, but, you know, we're going to take away your stimulus payments and this and that. Well, let's see how things change now, because for the past 4 or 5 months, nobody cared. They were getting an extra 600 a week.
Yeah.
Now, guess what? That 600 a week ain't there. And now when your unemployment's 260, it's kind of hard to live on 260. It's a little easier to live on 860 when you used to live on 500 a week that you were making.
Yeah.
So, you know, who's going to cry about making an extra $1,500 a month than what they usually made working, which doesn't even count the gas you save, the lunch that you would bring to work and save, and all that little extra money that you would have every week. So it's like, people are wearing masks. You told us to wear a mask, what, 6 weeks ago? The numbers are the numbers. The masks aren't stopping anybody from getting it. Maybe it's helping stop it, but it's funny how in March and April, we've had way less cases than we supposedly do now. Yeah. And you could skew it any way you want. I'll say, hey, my wife had to go back to work at the casino, and they tested 10,000 people that day instead of 600 people. And the only people that came in to test in March and April were the ones who had symptoms.
Right.
You know, yeah. Getting off on a tangent since we're talking wrestling. But it's just, you know, amazing. Our fans want to have shows. We want to have shows. You know, the wrestlers want to wrestle. You know, we want to get things going again. It's like, how long can we stay? You told us in March to stay around, and then it was April, then it was May, then we opened it up a little in June. Oh, there's a bump. Now we're already into the middle of August, pretty much.
Yeah.
So why is it going to be different in September, October, November? I don't see it being different. So does that mean now we're hoping in January we can run a big show and come back with no escape in January? You know, who knows? It's like, it's just getting tiresome. It's like, you know, let's get it going. You know, for some people, it's a horrible virus. And for 99.8% of everybody who either gets it or doesn't get it, it is as mild as a small cough. So, yeah. You know, it's a difficult thing. And it's like, yeah. We've run into some people now who've gotten it, you know, and I haven't heard anything that they're under the weather in any way. Yeah. You know, somebody took a test because their father had it, and then they happen to live in the same house, and then they got it, but they didn't have any symptoms.
Yeah.
So, you know, now here we are, August 11th, and I'm looking at my wall of all the phenomenal shows that we've done over the years. Moment of Truth. I got Matt Hardy, Brian Cage, Tyshawn Alcatraz, you know, Adam from Reno Scum on a poster, the 10-year anniversary, which we were looking to surpass, that had Cross and TJ Perkins and Chris Bay and Kenny King and Sepha and Hammerstone and, you know, Graves and Remy Marcel. And it's just like a who's who on this wall. And we just want to get that back.
You know, you just brought up all of those names and the shows. I saw recently here within the last couple of days, you guys are starting to, you just found the old videotapes and you're going to start digitizing FSW stuff from.
No, there are already files in the system. Wow. When we first started. So we got a lot of footage from like 2012 and 2013. I kind of knew it was there. It was connected to my old desktop, but you know, and then you have some of these drives that stopped working, and you had the I don't even know what it's called anymore, where you would take the drive out and you would put it in a casing, basically, and it would read it from there. So they were only like about a gig each, but we have about 900. Not a gig each, but like a terabyte each. So we have about almost one full terabyte of unedited matches. You know, some of them are edited. Some of them have commentary. Some are just the three camera versions uncut that, you know, features the early days. I was going through it. We got Chuck Palumbo and you know, Johnny the Bull when he was feuding with Franco and Alcatraz and stuff like that. You know, and then early, you know, Commandos against Reno Scum and, you know, Remy Marcel and Funny Bone teaming up as the tag team Sex and Violence. And they were taking on the Hater Nation. And then we had the Dude, Bryce Harrison, teaming up with Remy against the Hater Nation. And Willie Mack against Eli Drake. And Natural Selection, which was Eli Drake, Sean Ricker, and Brian Cage together. They wrestled a team I put together called the Sons of Texas, which was Brandon Gadsden and Jody Christofferson that we had high hopes for. So, and then Jody ended up getting signed by WWE.
Yeah.
And he was down, you know, and wrestled on some NXT shows and stuff. And he was a really good talent. The crowd really dug him, you know. And, you know, he was definitely another guy that we didn't really get to utilize that had great promise.
Did Jody come from Texas?
No, but he okay. He lived up in NorCal where his father, Chris Christofferson, lives. Okay. And whether he was from there or not, I'm not sure, but Jody would come out in a cowboy hat and a vest, so he looked like he was, you know, a Southern boy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. Let me ask you about when you think back to some of those cards that, you know, you're finding these matches, you're going to have a good amount of stuff coming out. What would be your process in terms of, are you guys going to go through and like add some commentary, and where are fans going to be able to find the content?
Yeah, you know, we've redone the entire office where I'm in right now, and it's been the production studio where we've been doing the live Twitch streams. You know, we have the black screen, the green screen over to the one side. We now have, you know, the mixing board where Felix does the sound for the events. We moved everything into here, but now we've added a couple of desks that have one over here with like a 10 terabyte drive and a house computer. And then on the other side, we got like three monitors and a couple more computers. So it's going to be a whole editing area because through the website, we have, you know, put in for interns, and there's people that want to help do things. So besides my son Joey and Mikey, who handle a lot of our production, we're also getting some assists from some younger people that are wrestling fans and they want to be a part of the business, and, you know, they want to come to a great wrestling show for free. So we kind of offer a trade-off. You know, it gives them experience and, you know, it helps us out. So the idea is I have a lot of the commentary still stored from the very first time we used the audio box. So I couldn't even tell you when we did it, but I remember doing it here in the office because everything used to be post, which in, yeah, you know, layman's terms means after the fact.
Yeah.
So we would do a show at Sam's Town or we'd do a show at the school, and then Disco Inferno would come in on a Tuesday afternoon and we'd bang out, you know, an episode of High Octane, or we'd bang out five or six matches. And Disco really would come in almost every week and we would do it. So now some of that stuff where maybe we lost that track, we still have the track edited. We just have to find the commentary again to put it in. But if we do stuff on the live Twitch, the idea is to basically do commentary kind of live so we can kind of interact with the fans because, you know, Twitch is a now thing and people want to interact immediately. And to succeed in Twitch, you need to get subscribers and followers. Yeah. And that's how you can bring in some income for all the work that's being done. So, you know, kind of like somebody offered to be a subscriber if we made a Macho Mouse emoji. Well, it doesn't take much to make one, so we made one and we got a sale.
That's pretty awesome. That's really cool. And with Fight TV, how does that work for you guys? Because I've always wondered, you know, Fight TV is a wonderful platform. There's so much content that you can look at. How did you guys come about being able to work with them?
Well, Michael Weber, he's a guy who used to be a main guy in the productions of WCW. Then he was involved in Global Force, and that's where I kind of met him. And then he became the boss of Fight TV, and I had met him because Ring of Honor, when they were in town, was using the Fight TV platform early on, as well as DirecTV stuff. So with Fight TV, it was another avenue where people, you know, they cut the cord. They don't have DirecTV anymore. Yeah. So the only way they could get it was online, and it became the online platform. So initially we did a couple of things where I believe it was when Stars Collide was the first one we did. And what we did was we filmed it all, probably did the live commentary, and then we had to edit everything because back then we didn't edit anything. We had three guys with cameras. You know, we had a hard mount, the two roamers, and we'd do it. And then probably Joey put the show together, and I had to upload it through the Sony Vegas, and then I had to spend, you know, 6 hours uploading it to Fight TV. And you know, we might have did 40, 50 buys. Yeah. And, you know, the price point's $15, but it's owned by Google, so they take the first 30%, and then the rest is kind of split. So basically the average is you're getting about $5 per buy.
Okay.
So we've seen that as a platform. And now recently they've offered a basically like an all-you-can-eat buffet at Fight TV where you can pay, I believe, $8.99 or $9.99 a month, and you have access to every single title that Fight TV has ever had.
Yeah.
As long as the – like they couldn't use ours without us signing a contract. So I won't say all the Ring of Honor, all the Impact stuff's on there. I don't know. But there's a lot of really good companies, a lot of good MMA stuff, a lot of good boxing stuff that I believe it's like $49.99 for the year and it's like $8.99 or $9.99 for the month. And we get a piece of that also. I actually just got a check from them. Wasn't nice. Much, but it was still a check.
Yeah.
You know, it would pay for a couple of wrestlers on a show.
Yeah.
You know, not flying wrestlers, of course, but, you know, a pretty good wrestler – you know, out of SoCal that we're looking to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's become a really good platform for us. The bigger shows, as great as Twitch is, and we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars, we want to bring in stuff. So, like, when we had Natural Born Killers, the first one we did with Moxley, you know, we probably did 100 or so pays at $5 a piece. Plus everything what we did on YouTube and the other stuff, we probably brought in a few thousand dollars from the media platforms that we had from the Natural Born Killer show, just from the YouTube revenue. And, you know, we need to be, you know, at a place where Impact and Ring of Honor and even GCW is, where they do so many buys that nationally when they put something out, because I'll put our Mecha shows up with any show, period. And we just need more people to be aware of it. And that's the key, is trying to get the exposure out there for people to say, oh, shit, what a great show this is. They got Pentagon and Phoenix. They got TJ Perkins. They got Matt Sydal. Oh, that guy Hammerstone's great. Chris Bay, Kevin Cross, you know. I was thinking about it as we were driving in about, you know, what we're going to talk with and what we were going to discuss. And, you know, we talk about these companies that are, you know, basically they're considered the national company, an MLW, an Impact, a Ring of Honor. And it's like, those companies are fantastic. They're great. You know, they use some of the best talent there is. But if you go to any independent wrestling show, and then you go to a show at Sam's Town, we've created and use more stars than I think anybody in the wrestling business.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to go out and spend big money to get Pentagon and Phoenix on your show. But how many shows used Chris Bay, used Hammerstone, used the Reno Scum, used Brian Cage, Eli Drake, Willie Mack, all on one show?
Yeah.
And those were guys that were kind of on the rise, but they were our regular crew. You could see those guys at the FSW Arena.
Yeah.
For, you know, $10 or $15 general admission, $25 for front row to basically see all these guys that are in major companies throughout the world. You know, yeah. You got Damian Drake and Vandegrift there. They're wrestling the shows in AAA. You know, so it's like, and these are our homegrown guys. You know, Willie Mack may not be homegrown, but we've used Willie Mack as much as anybody else has in the business. Yeah. And he's a SoCal guy, and we were using him then. Eli Drake, Brian Cage, the Reno Scum, they've been with us, you know, since 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so it's really amazing that when you look at the talent base that we have presented, you know, here, we are like the best kept secret. Even though we're pretty well known, I really believe we should be way bigger than we even are.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And I think a lot of that, too, just hinges on the fact that your approach is definitely an approach that many people just don't think that way. And you've come up with a great formula. Just this week, it was announced, just I think like 2 days ago or so, maybe even yesterday, the NWA is now going to be doing weekly television in Long Beach, California. And
very well aware of it.
Yeah, I kind of figured you would be. Is there a possibility? I know, you know, with that, we got Dave Marquez is involved with that. And you have a great relationship with Dave. Is there a possibility, because they said they're going to be using, you know, top independent talent from all over the country, that the Vegas base might just burst onto NWA scene?
Well, there's no doubt that we are interested. We've been discussing some things with Dave. So with Championship Wrestling from Hollywood in Arizona, you can see the FSW talent,
yeah,
that has made their way over there. So it isn't like anybody is a stranger to our crew. You know, right now we're focusing on what we're looking to do, trying to put this TV deal together. But in conversations that I have had with Dave, you know, there's a good opportunity for us to send some people over there. You know, it's the beginning stages with their partnership.
Yeah.
So anything we're talking about doing hasn't even really been conversated with, but it's definitely something on the table. And if it makes sense for everybody, you know, I'm not going to go there and send our guys in there to get thumped.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want it to benefit us, you know, and I don't even know the concept is, you know, would an FSW guy wrestle a freelance guy for the freelance title? Would an FSW guy wrestle another FSW guy to showcase the company? Totally unaware of anything they're looking to do. You know, all those ideas are great ideas. So, you know, if I have a conversation, hey, I think it would be great. Can we, you know, can we send, because at that point, being that it's that type of show with New Japan, I'm pretty sure a guy like Hammerstone, who's exclusive to MLW, or Kenny King from Ring of Honor, couldn't appear on those shows.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's enough Damian Drake, Sefa Fatu, you know, even a Chris Bay with Impact that's a lot more lenient.
Right.
To where on the Impact roster, there's a lot of opportunities to, you know, be able to wrestle. But who knows with MLW? They're letting Brian Pillman wrestle on AEW every week.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting for sure to see how that formulates. You know, we talked about LFC briefly in Sturgis. One of the people participating in LFC's card is Maserati. Let me ask you, when she first came in, what is the difference between when you saw her initially and her progress to the point where she's at now, where she's being able to get work for like the LFC, OVW, you know, she's, you know, possibly if they do stuff with NWA in the women's division, she would be someone who would be definitely considered because she's got a lot of experience and she's looking a lot better. You know, she was green at a point. What are your feelings on her and like, how did she develop with FSW?
Well, she was a good valet when she was here in the beginning. And wrestling wise, she wasn't a good wrestler. You know, she'll be the first person to tell you that. You know, the only reason she got on shows was because she was a good valet.
Yeah.
You know, she knew how to draw heat, but her work, you know, had a lot to be desired. And, you know, for whatever it was, you know, she was by the time she left to go to China, she had gotten a lot better, but she still was just okay. It's weird, but her time in China really paid off for her. She came back and she was a totally different wrestler. So I couldn't tell you. You'd have to ask her if it was a confidence level, because, you know, that's the most important thing.
Right.
You have to believe in yourself as a wrestler. So if you're a wrestler and your best attribute of being a wrestler is you're a really good valet, well, that's probably not a good sign for you moving forward. But, you know, she's been now used a few different times. Ring of Honor has used her. You left that one out.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? Yep. And she has proven herself that, you know, now that she's in there, and I see the confidence level is generally, you know, far superior than when she was there. You know, maybe it's because there's more girls to work with on a frequent basis at training, because a lot of times she was, you know, one of maybe two girls,
yeah,
that were training here. Well, now you got Lacey Ryan, who's awesome, and she's here every day. And Sandra Moon is like hot on her heels under Maserati, where she's younger and she's looking to be the future of the women's division. And Maserati don't want to be forgotten.
Yeah.
And you got Queen Estrella, who still has a long way to go, but she has the potential to be a women's champion in here in FSW.
You know, that's a good point. What is, when someone like the Queen comes in and, you know, she's literally like a ball of clay. You know, you're able to, the teachers are able to mold, you know, someone who comes in without any experience into an actual, you know, working professional wrestler, especially when you see someone who catches your eye as, you know, whether it's body type or personality, or, you know, you see something you want to develop. What are the keys in trying to progress that person to the point where not only are they successful, but they could take that success and essentially move it on to, you know, working in other companies, and then possibly moving on to a major company?
Well, first off, it's our job, because when you talk about any up-and-coming wrestler, a lot of times they're going to feel they're ready for the big time before they really are. And sometimes they might get an early opportunity, and then they think they've made it. And, you know, in her case, she was put in a good position to succeed. The problem is, you know, when you look at her and you see her, you know, it's hard to put her in matches that are going to go too long, because then she'll get exposed. So you're trying to protect as much as you can while she's going through the learning process.
Yeah.
Like, I know Remy's been working with her sometimes before classes or after classes, a little, you know, one-on-one training and things like that, because we all see the potential.
Yeah.
But she's not there yet, you know. She's someone, as a monster heel, is someone we would think could be a legitimate threat for Lacey Ryan, but I'm not the person who's going to put somebody there just because they looked apart. She has to be ready.
Yeah.
You know, if she beats Lacey Ryan for the title, it means she got good enough to win the title. Not, hey, she's a big girl, she'll grow into it, let's let her win, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not how I work. Like, you have to be overly ready. You know, you got to be, you know, well done, as they say, instead of medium.
Yeah.
Before you can get to that level. And we've had a lot of guys, and you know, I remember with Remy, when Jack Manley, who had been around forever in their circles and was up in Alaska and came down, and I remember Remy pitching for him about No Limits title. It was probably 2 or 3 months after he got here, and it's like, bro, let's chill. Let's get him over. And we got him over, and then finally he did, I believe, either an I Quit match or an Iron Man match, and that's how he won the title against Saiku, and it was the right time. You know, just because, you know, the biggest misconception is when you get a push and then when you stop getting a push is that Joe DeFalco don't like you. And it's like, it's people do not take responsibility for their actions.
Yeah.
You know, when you decide that you're going to train 4 or 5 days a week to get there, and then you think you've got there and now you're there once a week, no offense, but when you only have a couple of years in the business, you're not that great. You still can be way better. You may be very good for somebody. You may be excellent for a guy who's got 2 years in, but I guarantee you, you're not excellent for a guy if we said you had 10 years in.
Right.
And the key is getting people motivated. So once they, and we've seen it, people get on, even with referees, like they get to ref a match, they get to wrestle a match at Sam's Town, and it's just like, they let out all their anxiety and they think, okay, well, that's it. And then there's never any upward movement. And then that's why you see certain people surpass other guys that have been around here.
Right.
You know, it's nobody didn't not get pushed because I personally didn't like them. If they did good business and they work hard, I will give you an opportunity. I don't let personal issues, you know, stop you. If it's too personal an issue, I just don't use you. I don't need to.
Right.
I have more than enough guys. So usually a personal issue is because somebody doesn't want to do business. Somebody thinks they're deserving of something that I know they're not, and they're not happy with it. So mutually it's kind of agreed upon. Well, then, you know, it's not the right fit. We've had numerous guys. You can look guys that have been back and forth here for 7, 8, 10 years that it's always, what about me? You know, they're not concerned with the entire picture of the show. All they're looking for is their highlight reel. And, you know, obviously when you have a match, you want people to go out there and do good stuff. But there's certain things the early matches and the younger guys shouldn't be doing because we're setting a tone for the show. And that's the hardest part, because when you're a young, inexperienced wrestler, and in most cases you'll talk to other people, and you think the best way to impress Joe DeFalco is to go out there and do these super cool flips and do some super cool shit, because that's going to get you booked. While in reality, the guy who gets booked is the guy like Bryce Harrison, who comes in, I put him in a match, a fray match, which is, you know, two guys start, every minute another guy comes in. He comes in, and in 30 seconds, he gets his ass beat, and he's knocked out. And then on the next show, he does something else. And then you give him a little bigger part. But generally, the first step in being on the wrestling show and then being on it more consistently is making your opponent look as good as you possibly can and doing a great job of it, which gives me the confidence to give you a little bit bigger opportunity. Yeah. And now all of a sudden you have the opportunity to showcase some of your move sets and offensive skills. And then if you do well there, then maybe you're in line for a push. You know, Chris Bay, you know, we knew the talent was good, but we don't know where he was going to go. When he wrestled Funny Bone thumped him. Yeah. You know, here's a 20-year vet, and here's the kid's first match, you know. And he did his job well, and then he continued to do his job well till it's like, man, this kid's better than a lot of the guys that are already on the roster. It's time to give him an opportunity. And he became the young and up-and-coming superstar. And doing that paid off. Just like it did when we brought in Hammerstone from the very beginning, where he was, you know, a couple of years in, green as green can be.
Yeah.
But you knew something was there. And I remember a couple of veteran guys that I needed them to make Hammerstone look good. One did, one didn't. And the one that didn't, his boy, who was a former FSW heavyweight champion, laid into him and accused him of sandbagging Hammerstone because, you know, he wanted to shine.
Right. With that, along those lines, is there anyone who's currently developing, you know, not like Chris Bay or Cross or anyone like that, but anyone who's currently developing still that you get word back that this person, even though they might be still a little green or, you know, or just starting to come along, have taken the extra steps of, you know, after they go back through the curtain, you know, asking certain people, hey, how was my match? Asking certain people to watch their match when they go out. Is there anyone that stands out to your mind who is putting in those extra steps, the effort showing that they really are passionate about what they do?
It's hard to say because generally when a show's going on, I'm doing the commentary.
Right.
So I couldn't tell you if Hero Lou is going back there and asking somebody something. I'm pretty sure he isn't. Not for any other reason than he's a quiet guy. He doesn't, you know, generally other than who he kind of talks with, I'm not sure he's what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know if he feels comfortable going up to Sin Bodhi and saying, hey, what do you think of my match? I know some guys will go out of their way to ask people, hey, can you check out my match? You know, I know guys like Cody and Remy, you know, Kenny, if he's around, they try to watch stuff and they'll critique.
Yeah.
You know, if Kenny's at a show that he's not working on and he's watching stuff, when somebody gets behind the curtain, you know, he'll kind of let them know exactly what he thought. I remember the last show we did, Cody was like that, to where, you know, there was a couple of screw-ups and a couple of things, and he got a little excited, as Cody can do at times. And, you know, it's that keto diet, I think, that he's on. And, you know, it's like, hey, Cody, go eat something, will you? And we'll take care of this. But I think we're fortunate that our staff has so many veterans and experienced people in it that before guys can even approach them, that they've already walked up to them to talk to them. Yeah. I know Hammerstone's another guy. I remember Shogun wrestled Graves at a Beers and Body Slams, and we were upstairs on the second floor, or the guys were upstairs, and right after the match, I saw Hammerstone going down the escalator to grab Shogun and, you know, put him over for what he thought he did really, really well.
Yeah.
And, you know, a guy like Hammerstone has really stepped up from, you know, the guy from Arizona coming in. It's, you know, if I had to say who's the locker room leader, I would say it's Hammerstone.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt. And hopefully we'll be talking to Hammerstone on an upcoming episode of the DeFalco Files. The ability to put together a show is something that I think is one thing that you guys do that is just spectacular in terms of whether it be the talent, whether it be the actual booking of the matches, the storylines, the production value. You know, all that stuff goes into it. But one of the other things that you really do unbelievably well that a lot of independent wrestling doesn't do is themes, and we've talked about themes before. But one of the things that I like to hit on is since Raw has unveiled their Raw Underground, what did you do in terms of coming about and getting together Natural Born Killers? And it's one of my favorite things that you guys have done. You've done two. And will there be a third coming up in the future?
Well, it started with Kevin Cross initially, where he was very interested in the old UWFI stuff from Japan.
Yeah.
And being where Kevin came from a combat sports background, it was always something that he would like to have incorporated into FSW. And it was just, you know, a difficult thing to do. The closest thing we got for that was, you know, when we brought in Timothy Thatcher for him to work, and it was more of that catch-as-can style wrestling match that, again, turned off some people, and some loved it. But it was out of the box, not the same match over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And Bloodsport had just done their first show, and I was intrigued by the concept of it, and I believe Cross actually worked the show. I think he worked British Bulldog's son, Davey Boy Jr.
I think so, yeah. I think you're right.
And actually, that might have been the second one, because the first one was Matt Riddle Presents.
Right.
Then it became Josh Barnett.
Right, you're right.
So, but he may have done the first one with Riddle. I'm not 100% positive, but I think he did. And after that, time may have passed or whatever, and I brought up the concept to him. I said, hey, I got this idea, which, you know, isn't my idea. It was an idea from based off that. And a guy that I partnered up with, this guy Aaron, we were trying to think of a name like, hey, you know, there's Bloodsport. We need something like that Jean-Claude Van Damme type of, you know, name for it that stands out. And then he came up with Natural Born Killers. And, you know, if you look at the poster for Natural Born Killers with Woody Bald on there, Kevin Cross sliding in was like a perfect poster.
Yeah.
And so I talked with Kevin and I said, hey, I got this idea. UFC has their WrestleMania weekend. I believe it was in July when we did the first one. And, or it might have been December. I don't even
remember. Yeah, yeah, it was December.
I think it was before the New Year's show. So I think in December, UFC was having their Hall of Fame. It was like a whole big UFC week. So I said, this, I believe, would be the perfect time to do it. We can incorporate some, you know, UFC fighters. Like the first name on the list to get was a guy like Dan Severn.
Yeah.
Like, Dan will be in town for the UFC Hall of Fame stuff. And, you know, we could save a little money because he's already going to be here, not worried about the flight. We had a guy like Stefan Bonner already around. Tom Lawler, who trained with us, worked some of our shows, was an ex-UFC fighter. I had known Frank Mir a little bit, and we had talked, and Aries was representing him. So we kind of got him into the mix. And then Simon Gotch, who was kind of running that gimmick early on in MLW and even WWE, as more of a strong style fighter.
Yeah.
And it was like a guy like Graves was somebody we were interested in because of his jiu-jitsu background. Douglas James. So we had Dave Mazzani, Gina Mazzani.
Yeah.
Kira Batara. She fought for Combates Americas. Dave got Randy Couture's son involved. We were trying to get Randy, but he was, I believe, like in Israel filming something. So the concept came together, and it was a potpourri, if you like to say, of professional wrestling slash MMA talent. And we didn't really know what it was going to do. We were going to put it in the FSW arena that on most occasions, the way it's set up with guardrails, everything else, we might be able to squeeze maybe 200 in there, but it's a tight squeeze. So what we did was we took out the guardrails and we basically made two rows in front of the bleachers, which a lot of times we did in successful shows. But on the side, we only had room for the one, right. But we added seats there too. And we just basically put a seat wherever there was any room. And we had about 275 and was legitimately sold out.
Yeah.
And this was before we never announced it, so it didn't matter. When we brought in Moxley, that was all Kevin Cross, who, you know, I've told the story before, you know, he told me to put some money aside. And on one podcast, I said the amount, which I probably shouldn't. All I could say, it was less than four figures. So it was less than $1,000. Okay. And he's like, you're going to wish you had put this much aside, but put that aside. I can't tell you who it is. And because it was the big UFC fight weekend, we knew Tito Ortiz was a big wrestling fan, a Chuck Liddell. Even Cain Velasquez was actually in the week before with Disco and Cross training, thinking maybe it was going to be him because we knew he was going to do some stuff with AAA.
Right.
And we really had no idea who it was. And then it became Moxley. And, you know, the crowd became unglued. Like, I didn't know until 30 minutes before fight time. Like, the doors were open, and I didn't even know who it was yet, because Cross wouldn't tell me. And, you know, if we would have known in advance that it was Moxley, we might have moved that show to Sam's Town and sold that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we saw the success of that one and decided about 6 months later would be the perfect timing for Natural Born Killers 2. Now the question became, well, how are we going to top the first one? And it's pretty much saying that we wouldn't, but the fact of the matter was, the first show, if the show ended when it ended before Moxley came out, it would have been universally praised as a fantastic show.
Right.
You know, Tom Lawler and Douglas James was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, Dan Severn is a legend, you know. You know, Frank Mir, UFC heavyweight champion,
yep.
You know. And, you know, then it was putting together the second one, and then Tom Lawler had to go to a wedding. He couldn't make it. And 2 days before the show, Graves got pneumonia or something like that. He got something. It was some kind of contagious disease. I don't remember what it was. But he couldn't make it. But in the time frame, we were able to get MVP, who, you know, now is the leader of the Hurt Business, you know, mixed yep. in with, you know, having Dave Mazzani again. And he brought in a Bellator guy, Ryan Walker. And Austin Aries actually fought on the show. And we had Simon Gotch. And, you know, Lacey fought Kira Batara.
Yep.
And, you know, it was another really, really good show. Stefan Bonner ended up fighting MVP. So, you know, there was some good shit on that show. So the question became, now Kevin Cross has gone on to bigger and brighter things. You know, we've actually had conversations, and we're pretty much looking to continue Natural Born Killers 3, entitled Filthy Brawlers, because our new host will be the one and only Filthy Tom Lawler. So we're just waiting for being able to do it, because, you know, there's guys that are a local that we would continue to use, a Dave Mazzani, his sister Gina,
yeah.
who, you know, still fights for the UFC, Jeff Cobb, who we weren't able to get last time because he was in Japan.
Right.
But then we also had TJ Perkins, who did work the second one, which I had no idea that TJ was so good in MMA that he was offered a contract for Bellator recently. So just locally enough, there's enough really good talent. And again, a Stefan Bonner again. We like Simon Gotch a lot. Super nice guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, who else we can use? You know, there's a few of our younger guys that have some MMA backgrounds who, you know, feel that they're deserving of an opportunity. And, you know, that could be their opportunity. Kind of like Raw Underground, I don't really care for the way that they're presenting it.
Right.
You know, kind of guys just come in, oh, hit him with a punch, it's over, low blow, whatever. It's a conceptual show, and if WWE would have made Raw Underground cinematically like Brawl for All and put stuff behind it in that manner and then run it like Bloodsport or Natural Born Killers, I think it would be a tremendous addition to the show.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But the problem is, you know, you can't overshadow the wrestling with this. So it's little spot segments that, again, doesn't give anything time to get over.
Yeah, it needs to go to the network itself and be a, you know, 30, 45 minute program.
Well, it's kind of like, go look at HBO 24/7 or whatever it's called. Well, if you're bringing in this new guy and you're using Riddick Moss, I saw, and it's like, well, how about this 3 minute video package showing this guy? Like, if you're going to bring in a Timothy Thatcher,
yeah.
show him coming in, tapping people out, looking like the beast that he is, and having, you know, go to the FSW page or even a company they worked with, Evolve, and go listen to a Timothy Thatcher put over his opponent for his upcoming match, and it makes you want to buy that match,
yeah.
and let alone you could see it for free, so you don't even have to buy it. How could you not want to watch it?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, look at it, too, where I think the funniest thing to me was, it was just like, hey, this thing is just going on somewhere in the arena, and there was absolutely, like, no one knew about it? Like what? There was
just security to get rid of these guys.
Yeah. One guy standing at the door. You know, it's like, okay.
You know, it'd be funny if all of a sudden Tank Abbott walked in and, you know, knocked somebody out or something.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, one of the things we talked about this week on our show was that guys like the Viking Raiders, all of a sudden you had a Viking Raider who is now doing Brawl for All. Are you now going to maybe build up that persona, get rid of this, you know, cartoon gimmick and make these guys legitimate badasses? You know, it's just that it's that weird way of coming up with, like you said, you want to establish newer talent, and at the same time, you got Shane McMahon's, you know, building up the guy they want to build up as he announces them, and then says, going against this guy. And it's like, okay. Like, it just, yeah.
I figure they'll build somebody up as much as they can just so Shane McMahon can knock him out in 5 seconds.
build up the WrestleMania underground where Shane
McMahon. Yeah, you know, maybe he could take out both the Viking Raiders.
Yeah.
Viking Raiders, the Ascension, this team, that team. There's 100 teams. Nobody gets a chance to get over. It's just 1 week, one win, 1 week, the next win, the other win, whatever. It's like, so why should Raw Underground be any less of a clusterfuck than what WWE puts out? As great as the talent is, it's like, you know, maybe one or two storylines come through as like, ah, this is awesome, but the rest is just filler.
You know, let me ask you about that, because you have the perspective that, you know, those people who are just fans, they always spout out the shit of, you know, oh, they should do this, they should do that. But they're just fans. They're just watching the product. You're someone who has experience in putting together shows and putting together storylines, putting together, you know, a cohesive product. What on that aspect that the WWE does, what kind of gets you, you know, turned off by it or makes you scratch your head going, how the hell are they doing that, from the perspective of someone who's put together great shows?
Number one, I hate the brand extension. You know, yeah. It's like you're the one company and you got to have two heavyweight champions, one U.S. and one Intercontinental champion, women's champions on both sides, tag women's champions, tag team champions. You got 100 belts.
Yeah.
And the belts don't mean anything because every time Apollo Crews wrestles, it's a non-title match and he loses anyway. So nobody who has a belt actually ever really wins their matches. So, you know, your heavyweight champion just lost to Bray Wyatt. Bray Wyatt gets to pick the stipulation. Why didn't he pick, this is going to be a title match.
Yeah.
You know, why are you going to fight a guy who's the champion and not fight for the title?
Yeah.
And, you know, so the brand extension gives way more guys opportunities, but they really don't get opportunities because they get a minute here or a minute there. And, you know, when The Rock and Steve Austin and Mankind and Triple H are running crazy in WWE, why would I want to see them not on SmackDown, only on Raw?
Right.
It's like, why not the best guys on both shows? Why wouldn't that? There's enough top talent. The thing is, WWE tries to hoard as much talent as possible, so they got to give opportunities. But the reason for the success when I was growing up in the 90s, even then after that was the Attitude Era, but it was, you know, they showcased Rick Rude and the Ultimate Warrior and Macho Man, and everybody you remember from the 1990s were generally superstars.
Right.
Now, if they were there today, you know, guys like Hercules and Haku and all them, you know, they were one of 30 guys. Now they'd be lost in the shuffle as one of 60 guys.
Yeah.
And you can't push 60 guys. You know, I try to say that on our shows. There's only 8 or 9 wins. You know, everybody thinks they should get a push. And it's like, okay, well, We have the Nevada State champ, we have the heavyweight champ, and we got the No Limits champ and a tag champ. So generally, those are four matches that are going to have wins. If you're a guy trying to climb up the mid card, unfortunately, you're going to be in a three or four way or a six man tag or whatever, and that's when you're going to get the opportunity to shine. Yeah. In WWE, it's like, well, you'd see Heath Slater for a couple weeks, and then you wouldn't see him for a few months, and most of these guys wouldn't be on, and oh, wait, here's the Ascension. They're going to get buried in, you know, 2.5 minutes. Oh, we're going to put the belts on the Viking Raiders for them to hold it for about 3 weeks. And it's just there's no continuity. There's no character development. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Like, you knew Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. You knew Ravishing Rick Rude. You knew who the Macho Man Randy Savage was. And in a lot of cases, they just beat up the jabrons and they got to showcase themselves. Now, a lot of these guys have just become jabrons that initially were getting pushed, or somebody who wasn't getting pushed. All of a sudden, I guess they changed writers, and now all of a sudden, they're going to make Apollo Crews, who couldn't win a match for 3 years, go on a roll and win the United States Championship, only to lose all the non-title matches after.
Yeah.
It's like, why do we care about Apollo Crews? I had him at a show in Phoenix against Matt Sydal and had one of the best opening matches of a show I've ever seen in my entire life. And somehow he goes to WWE and nobody cares.
Yep. You know,
because they didn't develop, no development.
That's a great point in terms of development of character. Let me ask you, in FSW, as long as you've been doing it, who has been your favorite character that has been developed during that time period?
Favorite character? That is interesting. The transformation of Bryce Harrison from the Dude to the Leader of the Following was tremendous. Crash Test Cody evolving into Cutthroat Cody. Hammerstone from being the Thor lookalike, Thor wannabe God of War to one of the best talents in the, you know, one of the best up and coming young wrestlers in the entire world.
Yeah.
You know, not just on the West Coast. He's one of the best wrestlers there is, you know. He had a powerhouse match with Michael Elgin. Yeah. You know, he had a really great match with Sammy Callahan. You know, he is a major league wrestler, and his character has changed. And then because he was considered to be too much like Triple H at the Impact tryouts, he showed up, cut his hair, had totally new gear, and tried to reinvent himself. Because he didn't want to be the next Triple H. He wanted to be the first Hammerstone.
Yeah.
And he has always gone out on a limb to better himself. So, you know, those are gimmicks, characters. You know, Sugar Brown was a bad MVP light impersonator named Tommy Danger, who after conversations with me, him, and Remy Marcel, the Sugar Brown character came to life, which, you know, has done him extremely well for, you know, quite a while now.
Yeah.
You know, and there's probably numerous others, you know, that I could think of, but, you know, guys like the Reno Scum, they already had that when they came here.
Right.
I'm talking about more guys that who they were beforehand and what translated, you know, after the fact. And, you know, there's a good amount that I had huge involvement with, and there was some that was all, you know, the person who did it themselves. You know, Remy went from the fun-loving fro guy to the 86er, who initially I wasn't a fan of, but, you know, I'm enjoying the renaissance of Remy Marcel,
yeah,
who really did reinvent himself. You know, he was, you know, the cheesy fun loving, Remy Marcel, Afromaniac, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, now he's made himself a guy that he may be undersized, but before you may have looked at him as the small no limits guy, but now you don't look at him that way. You just, you know, you look at him as a threat for the Nevada State Championship as well as the No Limits Championship or any title.
Is that, you know, I mean, as an actor, that is one thing that I think that stands out to me that's very important, and that is being able to draw on different sides of your personality and then being able to heighten that and bring that to a character. Something like that with Remy, you see the fun-loving side, and now you see the tough, you know, serious, you know, mafioso street-type guy. Is that something that you find, you know, kind of interesting that these guys can, you know, have these ideas and they end up doing one thing and they do it very well, but then they know they need to change it up a little bit and they're still able to find that part of them that makes them something that stands out? Is that something that you enjoy getting a chance to actually see and be a part of and help create?
Of course, you know, obviously you're always trying to transcend. It's no different in FSW when, you know, I'm looking at a poster. And on the poster I see Bugatti, Romero, Remy, Graves, Funny Bone, Hammerstone, Damian Drake, Chris Bay, happens to have Cross, TJ Perkins, and Sepha and Kenny on it. But if you look at that, there's those guys that are our regulars, Cody, they've been with us for 6, 7, 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, how do you change it up? How do you make it different? You cannot put out the same thing over and over again because it gets boring. Nobody gives a shit and they don't want to watch or come to the shows. So we're always, not only are we trying to evolve, they have to evolve to make them basically to have the ability to continue to be relevant. Damian Drake was in a great position, decided it was time for a change, and now, you know, with his friendship with Matt Vandegrift, who now lives in Vegas, now all of a sudden these guys are together 24/7. So they wanted to be together, and the Unguided came out of it, and we look forward to what they're doing. Guys like the 1% with Royce Isaacs and Jarrell Nelson. You know, I put two guys that were floundered in the low mid card as singles wrestlers, and putting them together, their hard work made them possibly, well, you know, the tag team of the year in 2019.
Yeah.
You know, so it takes both parties. You know, I've had many tag teams that were single guys that I put together that shit the bed. They didn't give a fuck. They didn't work on any tag stuff, yet they were training local guys, whatever, that they just didn't want to do it. So when you don't want to do something, you're not going to put forth the effort. You know, when we put the following together, you know, we added Jake. We figured Cody was the perfect babyface to turn at that point. And then we were discussing who the last guy would be, and it ended up being a guy named Big Duke, who was another guy at that time, was floundering as a low card guy working some matches, wanted to come to Vegas. He was a big dude. He ended up fitting in the following, and everything pretty much gelled.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, we can go on and on about, you know, the Players Club, the Hater Nation, you know, stuff that we put together, the agency, which, you know, didn't work out as well. But, you know, that was an example of some guys who were kind of put together in tags that didn't really want to be. They wanted to do their thing. And, you know, at that time, that was all that was there for them. You know, sometimes you're trying to get guys on, and the only way to get them on is to put them in a tag team, which, you know, we were happy to do with, say, Damian Drake and Matt Vandergrift, because the No Limits division is so loaded, it's hard to get some of those younger guys on. So moving the tag team there, it frees up a spot or two for a singles guy, you know, whether it's a Ricky Tenacious, who's come a long way,
yeah,
to get more opportunities instead of being on some random shows whenever there just happened to be a spot. You know, once Ricky got on shows more frequently, he was able to build on his character and become one of the most despised wrestlers in FSW, which is understandable because he's an asshole. So, you know, it's easy not to like the dude.
What's your favorite Ricky Tenacious song?
I have none. They all suck.
I'm going to pivot on a couple of questions here that I just, as we're kind of getting close to wrapping up, I want to kind of get a little, you know, inquisitive here on some questions that I've had that I definitely want to ask you.
That you've just been eager to ask, but you were afraid to.
Exactly. The first question is, being that Vegas is UFC's hub, have you had any interactions with Dana White and UFC at all?
No, I'd love to have a conversation with him. I think that fucking dude's hilarious.
Yeah, seriously. He'd be awesome.
I talked to Jeff from Tough Enough a lot. But they're basically the precursor to the UFC, where
right.
A lot of, you know, Ronda Rousey started there.
Right. So,
Dana White's too big time for us.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, if you looked around and is it hard to make a relationship even if you're in the same city because of the fact that they're, you know, such a big, you know, worldwide company?
I'm pretty sure if I called the offices and said, "Hey, I'd like to speak to Dana White," and they said, "Who's calling?" and I'd say Joe DeFalco from Future Stars of Wrestling, the response back is, "Who the fuck are you?" You know, I love what I do, and you know, I'm well respected amongst the people who are in the business, but you know, Dana White is running a $4 billion company.
Yeah.
And he's got way more on his plate. You know, I'd love to say, "Hey, Dana, any chance we can use that facility you're using in Vegas, the Apex?"
Oh, man.
Because yeah. That place is awesome.
Yeah.
It's almost like the one that was at the Rio. The Fight Dome.
The Fight Dome. Like, yeah.
You know, there was people involved there with Vampiro that we ended up having issues with, but that was a great place.
Yeah. You know, speaking of just wrestling and setups and that kind of thing, I've always wondered, as a person who, if you want to get into booking or if you want to get into producing, starting a company, how do you get a wrestling ring?
You make contacts. I messaged a guy that is very well known in Southern California by the name of Jesse Hernandez, School of Hard Knocks.
Sure.
And, you know, some of our talent was trained there. Tom Howard was trained there.
Yep.
When Bill Anderson was the thing. And I'm like, "Hey, Jesse, you happen to know anybody who might have a ring?" And then it turned out there was a gentleman by the name of Bob Bradley, who was a trainer for Jesse, whose son, Bobby Bradley, once teamed up with Rob Van Dam, called Aerial Assault, and wrestled a lot in Vegas.
Yeah.
And they happen to live in Victorville. And the dad, Bob Bradley, had the ring. And he got us the ring. It had a trailer that later got stolen from the back of the school. But I think he gave us the ring in the trailer. It was like $3,000, which was a great deal.
Wow.
Because most people who bumped on our ring term it as the best ring they've ever bumped on. You know?
Sure.
Impact guys love our ring, other than the ropes being loose sometimes. But ring-wise, they dug it. And I remember we did the first show after that because Legacy used to let us use his ring.
Okay.
And they had the – if you look at the old – I think the first two shows, maybe the first one, not positive of the second one was, but he had like a blue vinyl canvas. And it was like, you know, it just reminds me of like, you know, going to see like mud wrestling or something. you know? So,
wow.
So we got the ring, and I remember Bob actually came down from Victorville for our first show with the ring. He wanted to see his baby off, you know?
Wow. That's cool. Another aspect of producing shows is getting the word out and promotion. Who does the posters for you guys?
Generally my son.
Wow.
He does a lot of the posters. There's a guy, Darian, who did a bunch of them in the past. A guy who's no longer with us did a good amount of them. But for a long time, the Darian guy, I'm looking at the one right now that's an awesome-looking one. It was for Moment of Truth, and it had, you know, Hardy, Brian Cage. It was Tyshawn and Alcatraz and Bryce Harrison and Adam of the Scum when they were fighting over the No Limits title because Luster had been injured.
Right.
And, you know, that it has, like, a background that – you know, it looks like a whole bunch of lights behind it, you know, like you know, fireworks going off. It's just a really, really good looking poster.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think, you know, most people don't think about when you are a promoter and that's your job. The fact of the matter is that if you look at some of these promotion, you know, flyers or you know, things they put on the internet, you won't see places, you won't see dates, even sometimes you won't see times. It's just amazing that, you know, people don't put that.
Yeah, I'll tell you something, we've made those mistakes sometimes, you know what I mean?
Sure.
That it gets lost in the shuffle trying to get the venue, you know. It's easy to miss something, you know, like even on this one, it says Samstown Live. It doesn't have the address, but it says Samstown Live.
Right.
You know, it has the bell time. It has the meet and greet time. You know, all the posters I'm looking at now, you know, do have it. But there was plenty of times I know for a fact that it was like, oh, shit, you know, we don't have the date or we don't have the time. I remember we had ordered flyers and either the date was wrong or something else where I had a blackout with a marker and basically take 2,500 flyers and, you know, redo it.
Oh, man. You know, that's the dedication, though, because there are people who would just say, oh, fuck it, it's on the flyer, just pass them out. It's amazing. All right, I'm going to finish up on this question from something that came out this week from Hugo Savinovich, who likes to say outrageous things on social media at times. So Hugo says that Cross was a real-life mercenary and that he was contracted to do dirty jobs for mafia groups when he was younger. And that the mafia groups like Cross for a real-life hitman due to his scary look. Did you ever hear anything about that, knowing Kevin?
No comment. But what I will say is Hugo clarified his statements because Hugo was a announcer for AAA when Conan brought him in as a mercenary, and he was brought in as a killer in AAA, which kind of transcended the Kevin Cross into Killer Cross stuff.
Yeah.
Now, I know Kevin may have gotten into a fight or two. You know, now what that entailed, I don't know. You know, I worked at Crazy Horse too, and there was a lot of rumors and innuendo of a lot of shady activity that happened. But I can honestly say, with the same thing with Kevin, I am not privy to any of that information. So I cannot confirm or deny, actually on both cases, whether any of it's true.
Oh, man. It's just, it's so fun when stuff like that comes out. And, you know, Kevin is so good psychologically. And because of his look, you immediately go, man, okay, Hugo has said some weird things and strange things. But then again, he did work with him and he does know him. Maybe it's true. It's, yeah, I love it.
Maybe it is.
I love it.
Maybe you should ask Cross.
I'll try, but I don't think Vince's lawyers is going to let me.
You know, Kevin's a very honest guy. You know, anytime I've asked him a question, he's pretty much answered it. You know, even when we weren't, you know, on the best of terms. You know, I like to say Kevin, you know, again, what's the word? Kevin, when you talk about Kevin, there was times that the terrible twos, as you like to say, kind of sprouted up. Mm-hmm. To where, you know, he was very protective of his positions and unwilling to do certain things that were needed from him. But, you know, as time passed and as he grew up in the business, because, he was at Lucha Underground. He got guys like PJ Black and John Morrison and all these guys in his ear, you know, telling him what he should do, yeah. You know. And, you know, sometimes it's easier for a 20-year vet to say, I'm not going to do this, than it is a guy breaking into the business. So, but, you know, all said and done, you know, he came back home, he put over Chris Bay, you know, he did the business that we needed him to do, you know, Natural Born Killers was a huge success. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have had Jon Moxley. You know, he probably helped negotiate how we kind of know Austin Aries. And, you know, I had met him before, but, you know, I may not consider Aries a friend, but I'll definitely consider him a good acquaintance.
Yeah.
And, you know, little spoiler alert, you know, if we do come back with TV, I'm going to try my damnedest to have Austin Aries as part of the commentary team, because at the last Mecca, I thought his work was outstanding. I was just yesterday, I actually watched for the first time outside of being there live, you know, Willie Mack versus Sefa Fatu, and the knowledge that Aries possessed on the commentary, which again, you know, he's got to be good. When he was an unknown guy to Vince McMahon and WWE, they let him do commentary for WWE television.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and he's a smart, witty guy, you know, and that's the coolest thing about him.
And that's the thing, exactly. He's actually very witty, and, you know, sometimes his humor may go over some people's heads, but a lot of times my humor goes way over people's heads, you know. They take everything too seriously. So, which is how the world is these days. So everybody takes everything serious. You can't say anything, whether it's in a joking way or not. You've offended somebody.
So I'm going to ask a final question, and this is off topic, off wrestling. This is just me asking you, as a bona fide Italian, what is your favorite Italian dish?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I'm also half Puerto Rican, okay?
Okay.
Everybody just always assumes I'm Italian, okay? And growing up, my grandmother's and my great-grandmother, my abuela, they would always cook. So every time we'd go to my mother's house, they were both there, and it was like they didn't speak English, but I knew all the food terms in Spanish. So yesterday, one of the students, Danny, I talked about a Spanish thing called a pastele, which is similar to a tamale, but it's a Puerto Rican dish that I hadn't had one in like 30 something years. And he actually brought me some yesterday.
Wow.
So, but the funny thing was, because of my grandparents and great grandmother being alive, my mother didn't really cook a lot of the Spanish dishes. She ended up learning to basically cook all the Italian dishes. So, veal francese is one of my all-time favorites, but I'm also a huge linguine with red clam sauce fan.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
You know, that's kind of a toss-up, and of course, I always like a good chicken parm for a sandwich, but if I had to go dish-wise, I had one when I first came out to Vegas. I don't even know if you can consider it an Italian dish, but we went to an Italian restaurant. It was called Cangemi's. It was on Sahara, probably like near Valley View and Arville. Okay. And I went there, and they had lobster francese, and that was spectacular.
Wow.
Because I'm a connoisseur of food, you know, and whether it's a great cannoli or it's stuffed shells. Oh, there's another one, stuffed shells.
Yeah.
If you could go pasta-wise, you know, stuffed shells. You know, I got one A and one B. So it would be stuffed shells, veal francese, and linguine with clams. I can't say which one's number one.
Oof. Well, that I needed to wrap on because it is lunchtime, and that is exactly the thing that I needed to hear to make myself hungry. So,
well, here's one more thing.
Yeah.
If you ever talk to him, we were in the office. We had some stuff. We brought pizzas, and Sally almost choked to death on a slice of pizza. The Darien guy had to give him the Heimlich, and out came the piece of pizza. So you can end on that note. That's probably a better note to end on.
Excellent. Well, we're going to end on Sally almost choking at FSW. Well, thank you, Joe. This has been very informative. I hope the listeners got a little taste of our potpourri mix here today. And next week,
and I'll make sure we got Hammerstone next week.
That's what we're shooting for. So hopefully those of you listening will get a good Hammerstone episode next week. With,
and if you know, if not, maybe we'll get his lackey Graves to do it.
Graves, if you hear this, Joe DeFalco called you the lackey, not me.
You know, problem is, if you have Graves on, me and him will be talking about nothing about how shitty the Mets are. So.
Oh. Oh man. Well, looks like we got a lot to look forward to over the next week or 2 weeks here.
Could be a double episode.
Yeah. Who knows? All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, the truth is here every week. And please subscribe, listen, download, share, and review all the episodes of the DeFalco Files, as well as the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. And we appreciate your time, and see you next time.